I'm Madeline Walter.
And I'm Ben Axelrad, and we're both hypochondriacs.
I think I'm sick when I'm not.
And anytime I'm sick, I think I'm a goner for sure.
Welcome to Definitely Dying, the podcast about health concerns, both real and imagined.
Because it's better to laugh about it together than cry about it alone.
I have a runny nose and an ingrown hair, and
my knee hurts.
My armpit kind of hurts. Is that a rash? And I had Asian food, and that makes me feel kind of sick. I might be lactose intolerant.
Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of Definitely Dying. You hear what I did there? I spoke to you as though you'd listened to the podcast before. How bold.
I listened.
If you haven't listened, listen to another episode and then listen to this one. And welcome back. Yeah, we'll feel like it was just for you.
Yeah, you'll get the reference.
Ben, how are you doing? How's your summer going?
Yeah, not too bad. It's I feel like I'm finally getting past all of the neck and elbow troubles that have cost me my summer fun. I'm swimming again. It's so hot here in Los Angeles.
My gosh, it's hot.
But actually, because I know something's going on with you, actually relates. I just recently purchased earplugs for swimming, and they could not be more of a life changer. Like that inner ear thing, mm-hmm, where you get water in there, is like the bane of my existence. Like that and ears popping on the airplane, like it does not go away from me quickly. It drives me insane. Mm-hmm. I'm swimming with the grace of a sea otter. you have ear stuff, right?
Yeah, I've had some like weird ear stuff lately, and it's not pain. Yeah. I wouldn't call it pain. But like I feel like my left ear is a little clogged.
Yeah.
But just a little. Like, I notice when I do yoga, if I'm doing, like, inversions, like, if I'm doing a handstand or something, like, if I do it for long enough, when I come down, I'll be like, ooh, my ears feel, like, clearer than before, which makes me think they were clogged. You know, like, I feel like, oh, maybe if I could just do a handstand for long enough. I mean, I should clarify, I cannot do a handstand. I have to do it against the wall. I've like injured myself in my house trying to do a handstand because it's just my biggest dream to be able to do an unassisted handstand.
I use the wall too. Would you tip over? Is that what happens?
Yeah.
You like fall?
Yes.
That's like my huge fear. Like why I do them sometimes, but I really have a huge, it's less a concern for you because Ben/June will find you.
Yes.
Husband Ben / cat June will find you. Not to be confused with husband June.
Yeah. Or my cat, Ben.
Yeah. Which, it's strange that you have both of both.
It makes things easier because I can just say a name and I'll be right.
It's true. That is true. You would be found, but my big fear is, you know, just that I break my neck attempting to do a wall handstand, which isn't even impressive. Like, it's not unimpressive, like, because I know people that can't do them at all.
Yeah.
But it's not impressive.
It's not really impressive.
No.
Nobody would, like, go to the circus to see someone do a handstand against the wall.
That's just a bad circus.
Yeah. But my ear, it's a little bit clogged, and I wouldn't be worried about it at all. But when I was a kid, I got ear infections a ton.
Oh, really?
Like when I was like a baby, my parents had to use this little like squeezy thing to like suck all the earwax out of my ears.
Like a baster?
Yeah. And then like when I was growing up, I like swam a ton, just like recreationally, like, I would have died if you made me swim competitively. but every year we would go to visit my cousins in Ohio and we would spend 2 weeks on Lake Erie in a cottage. And it was, beautiful. And we would like swim in the lake for hours and hours every day. And then everybody would get terrible ear infections every year, and so we had to stop.
So you think it's from the lake water?
I think that's what a lot of my ear infections as a kid were from. And then I think this like little ear it's not even an infection, but I think if anything's wrong with my ear, I think it's because I went to Palm Springs a few weeks ago.
Oh, yeah.
And spent a lot of time swimming under the water. And I think a Palm Springs pool is like 90% pee-pee.
based on our conversations from recently, it might be 90% your pee-pee.
I know. Basically, what I meant was I spent a weekend sitting in my own pee.
You peed in your ear.
I do. I pee. If you listen to the Paul Welsh episode, you'll hear me make the confession that I pee in every pool I ever swim in.
Literally every pool.
If I'm in a pool for longer than 13 minutes, I've peed in it. So I
if
did.
You're anywhere in the world for longer than 13 minutes, you take a pee break.
I do. I can't stop peeing. I can't stop. When I was in elementary school, a teacher I had, she was like, I guess kids were going to the bathroom too much. And she was like, if you have to go to the bathroom more than once every couple of hours, then go to the nurse.
Whoa.
Something's wrong with you. And that really stuck with me.
Yeah.
But I think maybe I am sick.
Yeah.
That's why I pee all the time. But I guess I gave myself a possible ear infection from peeing in my ear.
Yeah, it's awesome. I've never had an ear infection before,
really?
which seem really common.
Yeah.
Or it's possible I had one before I was aware of my own health.
Yeah.
But definitely none in the post-adolescent section of childhood, and none as an adult.
Yeah.
My ear thing is that I can never tell where sound is coming from.
So your ears don't work.
Yeah. 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 If I didn't see you and you said my name, I would like spin around in a circle looking for where the sound came from.
Has this always been the case?
No, it's definitely an adult onset thing.
So you have like no depth perception, but for sound.
Yeah, or for vision.
Wait, do you have no depth?
As we talk it through, yeah, that's also an issue.
Wait, really?
I don't know. I don't know if it's something all the time.
Yeah.
But I do know that whenever I have any, like even the smallest amount to drink, like alcohol drink, I can't properly find the table with a drink and I slam it down accidentally.
That might just be a low tolerance.
Yeah, I definitely have a low tolerance. It doesn't happen that frequently with like non-alcoholic drinks.
Yeah.
I would say I don't have great depth perception in general, but no,
here,
it's not.
This.
Yeah. Okay. when are you going to throw
Ben,
it? When are you going to throw it?
Ben just did a very funny thing where I threw a coaster at him and he didn't even try to catch it. And somehow it actually surprised me enough to make me laugh. Yep. Guys, we're a couple of very simple people. We're very amused.
But hey, we got a fun podcast. So let's get it started.
Let's get it started. Guys, we're here with a really great guest today. We're so excited to have her, Charlene de Guzman. She is a writer, a performer, a comedian. She kind of does it all. You might know her from her viral video, I Forgot My Phone, which if you haven't seen it, look at it. It's really great. It's like not what you think of when you think of a viral video. It's really more of like a beautiful little short film. Mm-hmm. So look at it. It's cool. She is on Twitter at Char Starlene. That's also her website, charstarlene.com. She has a book coming out this year called You Can Do It, Just Change Completely. And she also has a Kickstarter coming up. And I believe at the point of this being released, she has like a week left in this Kickstarter. So do you want to tell us a little bit about your Kickstarter?
Yes. So I've been working on this film for a while. I initially developed it with Mark Duplass of the Duplass Brothers.
Cool. Cool.
The film is called Unlovable, and it's a comedy about a sex and love addicted woman who discovers intimacy for the first time by playing music with a reclusive man.
Oh, cool.
And it's very personal to me since I am a recovering sex and love addict, and I just want to bring a film full of heart and comedy and really good music and, you know, I have a great team behind me that Mark set me up with, and we're doing it ourselves, and
awesome.
It's really exciting, and I'm really excited about this Kickstarter.
Great.
That's awesome.
Hey, Give her some money.
What are you doing? Give her some money.
Give her some money. And what is it? So how can someone find it easily on? And we'll post it too.
Yeah, you know what? Just go to my website, sharstarlene.com, and you'll see the information there. Thank you for your money.
Yes, give her your money. And that's it for Definitely Not. Yeah. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you so much for your money. We will.
Thank you for your money. Yeah.
We're off to Mexico.
Goodbye.
Bye. All right. Well, Charlene, we like to start our podcast with the same question for all of our guests, and let's see how this one fits you. On a scale of 1 to 10, how much do you fear death?
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah, just a little light one to start. Yeah.
You know what? I'm gonna go with 3.
3? Okay. What does 3 mean to you?
I'm a little scared just because I don't know what that's like.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not scared in terms of, like, I feel like there's a lot of stuff besides the physical life, and that it's like way better than this, and I'm down with that.
Good answer. Good answer.
Yeah. It's interesting because I feel like people always, like, I feel like there are two ways that people answer this question. Yeah. Like, people either answer it with information about what they think the afterlife is, mm-hmm. or people answer it with more of an immediate sort of attention to, like, whether they're afraid of, like, pain or the actual act of dying. Do you find that?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it seems like, it seems like the numbers are inconsistent across the board, meaning like a 3 doesn't necessarily mean the same thing from one person to the next. So it's always interesting to hear, like, what a 3 is. You know, some people will throw out a 5 and they're like, is that high? And in my opinion, a 5 feels like very normal. It means that you're in between the two ends of the spectrum. Right. You're not so blissfully ignorant that, like, you're never thinking about it, but you're also not, like, consumed by it. And I feel like your 3 was, like, maybe somewhere in that middle range.
Yeah.
So what's the closest you've come to,
dying?
Yeah. I would never say the word, but
I will say that one time when I was a kid, I was choking on a grape and I was, like, staring at my brother, like, trying to, like, get him to notice me, and he wasn't really understanding. But then I, like, was able to, like, shoot the grape across the room myself.
Yeah.
That was kind of scary.
That sounds terrifying.
Yeah. That's terrifying. Yeah. And I was pretty young, and I just remember having a moment of, like, I could have died.
Yeah. And this son of a bitch wouldn't have done anything about it. Younger or older?
Exactly. Older brother.
Oh, man, he owed you. You're like his one responsibility is keeping his little sister alive.
I know.
He went and got the grape, threw it back down your throat.
He ate it.
Yeah.
Have your feelings about sort of mortality and death and fear, have they evolved over the years, or have they been pretty consistent throughout your whole life?
I think I before would fear it very, very much. Because even, like, when I was little, my parents are older. They had me when they were 40. So I remember the moment when I was a kid, like, doing the math of, like, wait, my parents are older than everybody else's parents. And I'm like, wait, that means they're going to die before everybody else's parents. And, like, freaking out about that. And I think that started, like, a really big fear of death. But I think, like, within, the past 3 years, I've, like, discovered spirituality and, like, now I'm, like, open to things now, and, like, I'm like, it's probably, I don't think it's bad anymore. I think it's a good thing, actually.
So you think, you believe it doesn't end? Do you have thoughts that could be easily communicated, or is it more sort of just like an internal feeling?
I feel like we have multiple lives, so we live several lives that our souls choose to live, and then when we're done with that, being in the physical place, then we go to, like, some other, like, higher level place. Like, I see it as, like, some, like, VIP club where it's, like way better than over here. Yeah. And it's, like, really cool. Like, I don't know. It's, like, a bunch of souls floating around not feeling pain.
Yeah.
That sounds good.
That sounds like the only, like, VIP section that is, like, truly worth that label.
Right. Yeah.
I'm more of a Club Med kind of guy, but I feel you guys.
You want to go to the Club Med of Souls?
Maybe, like, sort of more of an MTV Beach House kind of vibe to my heaven. But, you know,
that's,
I mean,
all the souls
you
just sort of gave up and decided to, like, get nice abs and that's
exactly.
it.
Yeah.
Bottle
just,
service.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The souls of date rapists everywhere.
Oh, no.
No.
I don't want to live. I'm not saying I want to live. Jesus.
Oh,
come
no.
on.
You walked yourself right into that one.
You walked me. You led me into that MTV Beach House of Shame. How dare you? Sorry, listeners.
Anyway.
Oh, no. I got anyway.
You got an anyway.
You're right. Anyway.
Do you think of yourself, so I'm assuming you don't think of yourself as too much of a hypochondriac. Is that accurate? Or do you tend to think you're sick when you're not?
I almost feel like I'm the opposite, where I'll, like, deny that I'm sick when I am.
Oh, wow.
But I wonder if that's because I feel like my mom kind of had some hypochondria stuff.
Oh, yeah?
And I wonder if, like, I decided not to take that on or something.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Can you give me an example of how your mom is a hypochondriac?
Well, she just, it was always a thing of, like, she's sick, she's sick, she's sick. Mm. And actually, later in life, she admitted to me that she knows that she was sick because she... It was my thing with my mom. I think that she was sick all the time because she didn't express her feelings much, her emotions.
Oh,
she
yeah.
didn't feel her emotions much. Or I just, like, realized, I was like, I don't think my mom's going to listen to this, so it's fine.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So you guys are cool. So I don't think she felt her emotions much. And she talked to me about this once eventually of, like, she thinks that's why she got sick a lot, too.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. And a lot of her problems were, like, vocal cord stuff. And, like, right now, she literally has no voice.
You're kidding.
Wow.
And she knows, though, it's because she never spoke up.
We did something on this podcast about that in an episode with Marcy Jarrow, where we looked up various what did it relate to? Was it astrology based?
It was it was like one woman who I can't remember her name off the top of my head, but like, she will associate your physical ailments with what is going on emotionally with you.
Yes, I believe
that
too.
So that was a big one, was people that had throat problems. It was that they were crying out, but they weren't releasing that actually into the world.
Yeah. I believe that.
Yeah. Well, you've had that expense.
Yeah, that's,
like,
that's
has had opinion,
yeah.
you've had a lot of that experience very specifically.
Oh, yeah. No, and I definitely think I'm a bottler. I think it comes, and not about extreme things, just I tend to be somebody who focuses so much on making sure everyone else is comfortable and happy that I often don't cry out when I'm in need of help. And I guess it manifests itself in I had a esophageal problems, which I was incorrectly pronouncing for a long time.
Esophageal.
I always thought it was esophageal.
Yeah. We were wrong.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you always thought it because I came to you with my own medical diagnosis that I had esophageal dysphagia.
That's true. I never questioned you one time.
And I appreciate that.
Yeah.
I mean, it cost me in life, but. But yeah. So, like, what kind of sicknesses would your mom get? Like, would they be extreme or just, like, was she always
sick? I mean, I feel
sick?
Like when I was a kid, she had at least, like, 10 surgeries or something.
Oh, wow.
A lot of, like, back stuff. And I know, like, back stuff is a lot of, like security and safety stuff.
Yeah.
Like finances and stuff. But she had a lot of surgeries on different things, but a lot of throat stuff. Like, I know there's a lot of, like, vocal cord stuff and then, like, thyroid stuff and... She was just sick all the time. Like, she'd have to lie down and she was tired and she was sick all the time. But I look at it and I'm just like, I think it's because she wasn't feeling her feelings or talking.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So are you, does that manifest itself in you being very open about your feelings? Is that, or
yes,
is it, okay.
I think so. I think so.
Can we talk about that kind of stuff? Okay.
Yeah.
Can we talk about the sex and love addiction kind of stuff? Okay, great. Yeah.
I'm happy to.
So, like, when did you think that, like, when did that start to be present in your life? Like,
well, I definitely, once I didn't know I was aware that I had this, like, maybe in 2011. But when I look back on my life, it's something that I've always had.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just even looking back at, like, if you look at my journals from elementary school, I was just, like, writing about boys all the time.
Really?
Yeah.
And can you, just for any listeners who like don't exactly know what the definition of sex and love addiction is, can you define it?
So I think many people know about sex addiction because you'll see that a lot portrayed in the media and stuff. But sex and love addiction is a lot different, where there's definitely like an attachment, a lot of attachment and dependency involved. So sex and love addicts are usually addicted to things that they mistake for love, like dependency or longing or physical attraction or sexual attraction or lust or neediness or rescuing or being saved, like things like that. So it involves a lot of codependency, involves a lot of attachment.
Okay. And so so sex and love addiction is one thing.
Yes.
It's not sex addiction and love addiction. Okay, gotcha.
Great.
Gotcha.
Great.
Okay, great.
Great.
So what would differentiate so we know that about sex addiction.
Right.
We know about sex and love addiction.
Right.
Is there just love addiction? Is that like a thing in
Yes.
And what would differentiate love addiction, sex addiction, and then sex and love addiction?
Well, I mean, I think they group them together because they kind of go hand in hand, but you can talk about them separately. But I feel like a lot of people will have both.
Yeah, yeah. Because
they go hand in hand. Like for me, like my sex addiction wasn't like what you see like in Shame or something of like, oh, I'm like going around just like having sex with a bunch of strangers. It was more like I want love so bad and I think sex is love, so I'll have sex.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. And so you said you first identified this in yourself in 2011?
Yeah. My friend had mentioned it to me because at that time it was like crazy. I was like with a boyfriend that I was completely codependent with and at the same time, like in quotes, in love with like this guy in a band that it was just ridiculous. It was ridiculous. It's like, it's crazy to look back on those times because it's just like, it was ridiculous. My whole world revolved around these boys.
Is it, so that would like consume all of your thoughts and all
everything.
Of your
everything. Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And so your friend was the one who was like, hey, maybe
sex and love addiction? Yeah. I was like, no. And I ordered all these books off Amazon. And I was reading this, and I was like, oh, yeah, this is me.
And so then So then how did things shift once you identified it?
Well, in 2014, then I was in this other relationship. And again, like thinking, okay, this is the one. And like, it wasn't the one. And like wanting to kill myself and like just getting in a really crazy place and like being like, okay, I guess I have to face this thing. Like, I actually have this thing. There's no denying it. I actually have to do something about it. So I started going to a place for group therapy that is specifically for this, for sex and love addiction. And then I joined a 12-step group for sex and love addiction.
Wow.
Yeah.
What's the first step?
The first step, well, all the 12 steps are all the same in all the 12-step programs, but the first step is basically admitting that you have this thing.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was in 2014.
Yes.
Yeah. And then, so what's that journey been like then? I mean, that's such a big question, but like, what are the...
Oh my God. It was the hardest thing I'd ever done in my life. Like, you really have to be desperate and have like been through a bottom or several, which I had, to want to do this because I had to go through a withdrawal, you know? So that was like no sex, no guys, like no contacting exes, no even flirting, no, you know, codependent relationships with friends, like really just being with myself and like learning how to love and take care of myself because I realized I had never done that for myself. So it was a horrible withdrawal. They've done studies where they compare brain scans and it's the exact same withdrawal as a heroin addict because it's the same chemicals.
So what were you two questions. What were you literally doing to cut yourself off? Because it feels like it's very simple if it's like a certain substance. You just stop taking that substance. So like what literal steps were you taking to make that happen?
Well, I mean, I was taking it a day at a time, like marking it on my calendar of like, I have to not contact my ex. Right. And that was the hardest thing.
Yes.
So doing that and then, you know, not dating, not going out and trying to hook up, not, you know, being codependent with my friends.
Mm-hmm.
What would an example of being codependent with your friends be like?
Like, so when I look back on my history, I do have some, I've always had like guy friends who I felt like I compartmentalized my life, where I'd usually date unavailable guys, but then I would get the intimacy of friendship stuff from like guy friends.
Right, right.
And I would find myself doing that a lot.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
What did you do instead?
Oh my God. Like, I had to like seriously come up with a list of things that I've always wanted to do, or like ways to take care of myself. So I was just like, honestly, exercise really got me through it.
Yeah.
Like, I was just working out all the time, hiking all the time, walking all the time, doing Pilates, doing yoga, doing that a lot. And then, but a gift from the withdrawal was definitely the creativity.
Mm. Yeah.
Because it was when I was in withdrawal that I wrote a pilot. That pilot's the pilot that I sent to Mark Duplass, who's like, let's make a movie. So I wrote a movie. I wrote some other screenplay. I wrote 2 10-minute plays. I wrote a book. Like,
yeah.
Like, honestly, all the stuff I didn't even know I was capable of. Because, again, when I was in my addiction, I just wasn't taking care of myself. Right. I didn't even know I had these talents.
Yeah.
It seems like, you know, especially when you compare it to something like heroin,
right,
that a lot of that sex and love addiction is about an instant validation.
Yes.
that you probably, if you're able to put that need aside, you're capable of doing much bigger things that would then allow you to feel that thing internally.
Actual fulfillment.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it is like a drug, where it is just a fleeting thing. Like, because even with these relationships, like when you look at the brain, all of those chemicals, you're high for like the first 2 to 3 years. Mm-hmm. And when those go away, if you don't actually know this person, if you don't actually like this person, if you're not friends with this person,
right,
like you're not going to have anything there. And that was my case, where I was getting with these guys that I really did not know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like all my boyfriends were like one night stands that just happened to stick.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's such an interesting way to put it, Ben, too. It's like that, like, like shifting from instant gratification to realizing that you don't need that because you are truly worthy.
Taking responsibility for your life.
Yeah.
But it's cool now, because now I've been in this phase where I'm in the good part now, because like now I'm not in pain.
Yeah.
I can see everything clearly, and I'm on this dating plan, which is really, really, really cool. It's been a really, really great experience, because you basically get to know a person. So it's like it's a plan. So like for like the first 4 dates, they're just like once a week. They're in the daytime. They're in public. There's a set start time, set end time. Mm-hmm. No physical stuff for the first month. Second month, you could start kissing, but now you're having 2 dates a week. Like very minimal contact in between. So you're not like texting or whatever. Like very cool stuff like that. And so it's been interesting, because when I started the healthy dating, like, I got to date a few guys and, like, you know, see, like, red flags. And, like, that's a big thing. Walking away when you see red flags, because it's not the guy, you know?
Yes.
So getting to, as my therapist calls it, collect the no's so I know what a yes feels like. Because I had never said no. So doing that. But then, now I've been dating a guy for almost 3 months who is amazing, and it's so great.
Mm-hmm.
But like, we've done this plan together because, you know, we both needed it. It worked out. It was a miracle, because we both had some of the same issues, some of the same histories, and we both wanted this and needed this, and we've done it, and it's been so fulfilling. It's so the contrast. It's so the opposite of what I've ever had. Like a few weeks ago, we had our first like overnight, where still we haven't had sex, but it's like, it's an overnight. And, you know, I was feeling a little fearful about it. And so, like, we decided to make it, like, a big deal, and, like, made it, like, a slumber party.
That's awesome.
And I, like, showed up in my pajamas and, like, brought all my stuffed animals and my pillows. And we ordered pizza. And I brought a coloring book. And, like, we did, like, talent shows for each other. And, like, we just made it so fun. And I was, like, I was in tears of happiness, because I'm, like, this is so the opposite of what a first overnight would look like before, where I would be blacked out. I would not know the person. He was probably terrible. I'd probably have sex. I'd wake up hungover, not knowing how I got there.
Mm.
And now I'm in this place where I'm completely sober, and I actually like this person as a person.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And this person likes you. And
this
that's like that's a big deal.
He's
is
available.
That like is that I think because I think especially yes, I, but I think a lot of that is, you know, I mean, I haven't necessarily had it in that capacity, the sex and love capacity, but that feeling that if you deprive somebody of what you decide is their ultimate aim, that mm-hmm. they're just going to walk away. And if you don't allow somebody to, if you don't allow somebody to take advantage of you that way, not that they would mean it maliciously, but right. if you don't allow somebody to force you to be less than the full version of
right.
yourself, then when they do get to know you, they get to know the real you.
Yes.
And a big deal Ugh. With all of us is that we think we're frauds. We spend so much time thinking that we're frauds.
Yes.
And we're not. We're just not honest with people because
exactly.
we don't think that they're going to like us.
Yes, that's what I realized that all the guys before this, I'm just like, I wasn't being myself. I was just trying to be this
yeah.
thing of like, maybe they'll like this, maybe they'll like
right.
this. I wanted to be loved so bad. But then now I'm in a situation where, oh, when I'm the more myself I am, the more lovable
yeah.
I am, you know?
And how good does it feel to be known, to be
oh
understood,
my God.
To
and,
be truly known
yeah,
and understood?
Yeah, but that's like the biggest fear. Like, that's the core of sex and love addiction is the fear of intimacy and the fear of being known, the fear of being seen.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this process, even this dating process, like it was uncomfortable at first, but then I did know that, okay, I just have to go through this to get rid of this feeling.
Yeah.
So like the more that I've been doing it, the more comfortable I feel.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you get the real validation that you need, which
yeah.
is one, I think it's a big deal to take control of our own lives,
mm-hmm.
to say beyond just, you know, beyond just that we are we're self-aware and
mm-hmm.
like, you know, the thing about the sobriety that you were
mm-hmm.
saying about like being in control of our
yes.
situation, but also to make an effort to do the thing that we say that we're going to do,
right.
because otherwise we don't know whether or not it worked. Like, it's easy
yeah.
to say, all right, I'm going to put this off for a month, and then things start to get really intimate, and then you say, like, okay, this guy's the one, I'm
mm-hmm.
going to put this off. But actually adhering to the system that you put in place, I think that's a big deal. I mean, I think that it's part of taking yourself seriously in the right way, you know?
Yeah.
And mostly what that means to me is not letting other people not take you seriously, not letting other people determine how you feel about
right.
yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is inspiring a lot of thoughts in me that have very little to do with you and entirely to do with Madeline. No, there's a lot of internal
yeah.
stuff going on.
Mm.
I'm a people
Great.
Pleaser, and that's
yes.
not that's a form of addiction also.
It
I think
is.
That's in the same
no,
sort
yeah.
of I think categorically.
We all have that,
yeah. But that like if I don't need to please people.
Mm-hmm.
I need to be the version of me
mm-hmm.
that I'm comfortable, that I'm pleased
mm-hmm.
with, and then the right people will stick around.
Yeah, just remembering
yeah.
that, like, when you take care of yourself, when you make that your focus, you're your best version. You
mm-hmm.
can be the most available. Like, people who actually do love you, that's all we want for you,
mm-hmm.
is for you to take care of yourself.
Right.
Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah. Because it's not – because – love, so I've heard described both ways, where like people describe love as a drive state, like a thing that until we, you know, the same way that like hunger is a drive state, that it's not going to go away unless you get that thing.
Mm.
Do you feel that way, or do you think love is a little like our human concept of love? Is it like, is it a construct? Is it contrived from some sort of addiction?
Well, I think, you know, the addiction comes from all those things, the people pleasing, all those external things come from when we have like this hole in our soul, when we have that and we're trying to fill it with all these external things, and it's never going to be enough because that's not what fills it. Like, you really need to find that love within yourself, and like there's just no exceptions to it. Like, I really understand now how like I can't even receive someone's love until I believe I deserve it.
Very true.
You know, so it's like it all starts there.
Mm-hmm.
It's like so simple, but so difficult.
So then once we've achieved self-love,
mm-hmm.
do you think that external love is necessary? Is it like, is it part of the human condition? Like, do we need love from our community, or do we just invent that, you think?
I think we definitely need love, but we are love, so we have the love. But once we are the love, all we do is attract love, because we attract what we are.
Mm.
Very well said.
Yeah.
Very well said. I like
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, because
right,
whatever
this podcast.
Yeah, I know.
I'm going to go learn to love myself.
Exactly. Because really, what we experience out there in the world, you know, whether it's our relationships or what people look like or what our career looks like or how much money we have or what physical ailments we're getting, I do believe that it's all a reflection of what we're thinking about ourselves.
Yes.
Yeah, that seems to really correspond with the stuff that you were talking about with your mom.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really do believe that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I 100% believe that I mean, it's not going to be everything. It's not going to be necessarily the cancer, or but we do make ourselves sick. And that we and I mean that in two ways. Like, I mean that in the sense that, like, we make our bodies ail, and I also mean that we kind of make ourselves sick. Like, we disgust ourselves. Like, we're so disappointed in ourselves for reasons that we would never ever disparage someone else.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, I do it constantly.
Yes, that's the thing. We're so hard on ourselves.
We're so hard on ourselves.
I see a friend that's hard on herself, I'm just like, would you talk to me like that, or would you talk to a little girl like that, or like little version of you? And it's like, no.
Yeah.
I remember. I feel like I recently saw. I think it was a headline. I don't even think I read the whole article.
Nice.
So maybe it was maybe it was a trick. but somebody recently, there was like some study done about how, like, so we're all loosely of like the self-esteem generation, you know, where like that's such a buzzword and that's how we like have taught our kids to think of themselves, like, you know, like, you're the best, have self-esteem, and how actually self-compassion is way more useful, and self-esteem is, now I'm extrapolating, now this is what I'm guessing they said, because this is what makes sense to me.
This is a better article to me.
It makes sense, because self-esteem is a little bit like saying, no matter what, you have to think you're great and feel great. Like, self-esteem means like, hey, if you don't feel like the coolest, neatest person, you're wrong.
Right.
Whereas self-compassion is more of just the idea of like,
your feelings
like
are valid.
Gentle with yourself. It's okay if you feel down.
Yes.
It's okay if you feel mean.
Yes.
It's okay. Like, all of this is okay.
Yes.
The only thing that's not okay is like trying to like cram and contort yourself into being something you think you should be, because that's when we start being mean to the people around us. Like, that's like the most broken way of thinking.
Yeah. Like, one thing that I learned while I was in the withdrawal, because in withdrawal, basically, you're just feeling all these feelings that you've avoided this whole time with your addiction. You have to feel them. That's the only way you get rid of them. You just got to feel them. So just so much feeling. So I found that, like, the suffering really does come from the resistance. So when you just, when you'll feel the moment when you just give yourself permission of just like, okay, I accept what this is. And then you'll feel relief immediately.
Can you give an example of like, of a moment where you really felt that in a very powerful way during your,
Like, so, I mean, I still have days where like, I feel a little down and like, okay, you know, my old, the old perfectionist in me is just like, why am I sad right now? I should be happy. Like, I have a lot of good things going on. Like, but why am I so grumpy right now? Why am I so irritable? Why am I annoyed? Blah, blah, blah. Why am I being mean to whatever? But then like, I'll have the moment where I'll just decide, like, I accept this.
Yeah.
I accept this. And then you embrace it with love, and because it's all it needs. And like, it, you'll feel a little bit relief in that moment of just accepting what is.
Yeah.
Do you remember when you were going through withdrawal, like a breakthrough? Like, obviously, it's never, it's always going to be a one day at a time kind of thing. Otherwise, we slip up.
Right.
But do you remember a moment where you stopped feeling like you couldn't do this and felt like, you know, like, if I stick to the course, I can accomplish this? Or not accomplish, that's not the right word, but you know what I mean.
I think after 100 days or so of sobriety from that addiction, I started to feel good.
Yeah.
Mm. And it was the first time feeling good.
Yeah. Mm.
And I didn't even realize how bad I'd felt all my life, because now I was feeling good.
Yeah.
But a really big breakthrough, though, is that I forget how many months was it? Maybe 6 months or so after sobriety, I went and hung out with my ex.
Because
I think I was like triggered by I saw my family in a long time, and that's like the root of all of everything.
Yeah.
So I was triggered. I contacted my ex. I saw my ex. But it was such a great experience for me, because I could see for the first time. All the fantasy and haze was gone. I just kept staring at him because he even looked different to me. And I was like, this is what he looks like? Like, I didn't even, like, it was just, everything was so clear. And I felt so bad while I was with him. And I just remember thinking, like, oh, wow, this is what it always felt with him. But I didn't even know, because I'd never felt good before.
Yeah.
Wow. So, like, that was, like, when I really let him go, because I was like, right. Like, I no, I don't like him.
Yeah.
It was really amazing. It was an amazing experience.
I remember when I moved to Hollywood, having like that feeling that maybe I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but having that feeling before I arrived that I was over all the stuff that bothered me from high school. And then I arrived in Hollywood and it felt like high school all over again. It felt like this is a popularity contest.
Especially the comedy community.
I realized that I hadn't gotten over it. I just left high school. And I think that maybe that's a big deal, is going back to a place that triggered you and not giving in. That it's easy to it's easy to not eat cake outside of a bakery, but if you, you know, if you want to prove that you're over my cake addiction.
I felt that a little bit, like to a lesser extent, but moving to LA also because when I was younger, I struggled so much with like body image issues.
Me too.
I thought it was normal because I think it is. I think we're taught to think that it's normal. I mean, we could go on forever about like, I mean, even just the fact that like you walk through a grocery store and any food is called guilt free or not. We're just like, we're really meant to, we're like rewarded for thinking of our bodies in a really unhealthy way.
Yeah.
And I felt like I like worked hard to get over a lot of that in college. I mentioned her on the podcast before, but like thanks to like my amazing best friend and college roommate. Mm-hmm. But like moving to LA, I felt like was almost the final step because there's so much body bullshit here. Yes. Like there's just so much of it such a profound way that I felt like I finally kicked it moving here because I felt like I had to kind of run the gauntlet of like, you know, of being like sort of bombarded with all of these like unhealthy and unrealistic expectations and sort of being in the belly of the beast. Yeah. I was like, oh no, I got this. Yeah. Like I had to work so hard that it felt like similar to what you were saying about high school. Like,
I mean, casting directors alone, like that profession is basically just judgment, like looking at you and judging. I mean, except for the good ones out there who give jobs to these two. And that good one is me.
Now, you said a lot of this stems from your family. Is that like from growing up, like from your family life? Is that a thing you can elaborate on or talk about? Are you comfortable talking about it?
I feel like everyone's present stuff is from childhood issues. Yes. You know, we don't do what we're told. We do what we see.
Yes. Yeah.
So, you know, I grew up thinking like, I'm never gonna, like, I hate my dad or I hate my mom. And then I end up, like, dating guys who are like my dad and becoming my mom, you know? Yeah. Like, it's just, it's crazy how you'll talk to people and that seems to be the general story of, like, hating your parents and then ending up being like
them. And it never ceases to come as a surprise to literally everyone.
I know.
Of course, you guys turned into your parents.
I'm my own man.
No, but yeah, we just, you're absolutely right. Because people tell us things and our brain will find a way to rebel against them. But we see things and we emulate them. We just, all creatures emulate success.
Yeah. Yes.
But we don't necessarily know what success looks like. It's just your parents did it. They survived it. They made children. So we end up doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. Even if we go, you know, they went left in order to get there. We go right, take much longer to get there, but we still end up in the same place.
But I think also the same is true with like the friends you surround yourself with. Mm-hmm. Like my little brother graduated from Tulane this year and their graduation speaker was Hoda.
What?
And she was honestly, she was amazing. It was the best graduation speech I've ever heard. And I heard Desmond Tutu speak at another graduation. It was so good. But one thing she said that it's not original.
So insulting to Desmond Tutu.
I know. I'm sorry. I mean, Desmond Tutu is certainly more historically important. But just speech-wise, Hoda, I love you. You won. Okay. You won.
No, it's it was just funny.
Was she holding a glass of white wine? Like, that's what I picture for some reason.
She, wasn't, but she did at some point take. She brought her iPhone on stage, and at the end of the a really wonderful speech, she was like, did this thing where she was like, "And New Orleans will always be your house."
Oh,
I can't think of anyone who could say it better than Flo Rida, and she put her earbuds into the microphone and played Flo Rida's song "My House," that song that's just about. Great. Coming to his, it has nothing to, it's wow. He's just like, you can come to my house. Like, that's all, that's the only relation that has to the sentiment of like, this is my house.
Wow.
And I watched an arena full of really lukewarm college students, like, be very unexcited about Flo Rida. But,
she may not have been holding a glass of white wine at the time, but if Desmond Tutu's listening right now, he's kicking back some wine.
I know.
Flo Rida topped him.
But one thing that Hoda said that stuck with me was you are like, you're the sum of the five people you spend the most time with.
Wow.
Which is like sounds sort of like a dumb like quote that like somebody's aunt would post on your Facebook.
Yeah.
But like, but
it does,
I feel
make
like
sense.
It's true. Yeah. And like, not even like you're the sum of your five best friends or your five favorite people. Like, you are the sum of the five people you spend the most time with.
That makes sense.
Because I feel like you can't help but like absorb and mimic like the energies and the actions that you see.
And again, like attracting who we are. So the people that we attract are who we are. And so, you know, I feel like we're all mirrors of each other, whether they're mirroring really amazing things or mirroring things that we don't exactly accept about ourselves yet, you know? I have a thing where it's like, if you spot it, you got it. So like, you know, sometimes I'll like see something in a person that I don't like and then just like, oh crap, I do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very similar to my he who smelt it dealt it.
Oh, is that yours?
That's me.
Yeah, Ben thought of that.
Ben's
70 years old.
I stole it from Desmond Tutu. That's where the tutu stands for.
Oh, my God.
Ruined.
Desmond, of your own family.
Yeah,
you.
Big time.
How'd you find this podcast?
Exactly. But Hoda, if you're out there, we really love you, girl.
Oh, truly, Hoda, if you are out there, I love you the most. Please tweet at us and call in the podcast.
Please,
I truly, I adore you.
You're the Facebook aunt of our dreams.
Yes.
Now, going through this process of recovery, have you noticed any physical changes, like the changes in the way your body feels, or like have you experienced that at all?
Yes, because I really do believe when you love and take care of yourself, then you feel better.
Yeah.
You know, because before recovery, I realized that I wasn't eating right, I wasn't sleeping right, I wasn't exercising, I wasn't doing anything to take care of myself. So going through this process of, you know, full on self care.
Mm-hmm.
I just feel great.
Yeah. What are some actual examples of things that you like? How have you, the lifestyle changes?
Well, exercising for sure, and then like eating nice things. Because I mean, I'm not crazy healthy. Like, I have a balance of things where it's like, well, I'm gonna have a dessert today, or I want fast food today. But like, just eating when I'm hungry, sleeping when I'm tired.
Yes.
I didn't have that before.
No, so big.
Yeah.
That, no, that stuff is huge.
Yeah.
So would you said that you had a lot of codependent relationships prior to the recovery period. Were you more protective of your partner in those situations? Like, was it a codependent relationship where, you know, where you focused entirely on their well-being and not your own? Or was it?
Yeah, it would be like, it was a lot of taking on the other person's stuff.
Mm. Yeah.
And now that I look back on that, it's just because I'm avoiding my own stuff.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But like, even like maybe the more drama, the better. Cause it's just like, look, I'm a good person because I'm taking care of this person.
Yeah.
I'm caring about this person's well-being. I'm being a good friend. And it's like, I was just avoiding myself.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Ben and I, we've been friends for years and years, and I do feel like, I mean, you're such a good friend, and you've spent so much time taking care of so many people. Yeah, I feel like in the past couple of years, like you had these like series of health problems, and do you feel like that helped you kind of shift your thinking a little bit and like force you to sort of have a similar.
No, definitely. I mean, it that was the thing. Like, it was, it, I say it and it sounds jokey, but it's, it was a serious thing. Like, I would get pretty, I would get pretty sick or injured for like an extended period of time, and I would sign up for Tinder. Because was what would remind me that I was alone in the world. Yeah. And so, and I am a terrible person in those regards. So I would, as soon as I got healthy, I would delete my Tinder account mid conversation. Yeah, I was like, oh, feeling better. Delete. But yeah, that it was, and it happened. I can't remember if we talked about this on the podcast before, but it happened 3 years in a row. On May 9th, which is the day before my birthday. And so 3 years in a row, I woke up on my birthday incapable of taking care of myself. Wow. And in one instance, I had to like flee my apartment and I went and stayed at a hotel and then ultimately moved in with my aunt and uncle, never returned to the apartment. The next year was, we've talked about this, a major groin pull, 4 to 6 week injury in that particular area where, and that's been a thing, is that like, is that in each of these instances, I couldn't have been physically intimate. Like this year it was, what was it this year?
Your shoulder.
Yeah. I pinched a nerve and yeah, that's been going on for like 2 to 3 months now.
Wow.
And but I would get like, I would get very lonely during it, but I couldn't act on it. I was incapable of, you know, doing sort of some of the things that you were describing, is, you know, locating some sort of like immediate respite from the suffering.
Right.
At best, I could like, you know, Tinder text message some girl who I was. Unfortunately,
you know what? What I see from an outside perspective is like you're getting these injuries, so you have to you have to be with yourself, and the Tinder and all the stuff, like that's not gonna fix it. Mm-mm. Like it is really you learning how to embrace yourself.
Yeah, and also a willingness to allow. Like sort of what you've been talking about subsequently, which is like a good kind of love and affection into your life, where you're not, you know, because especially in those, you know, no one feels comfortable asking for help when they're at their worst. It's like, what do I have to offer you in return? You know, like we're such a society of reciprocity. Like I give you this, and in exchange you give me that, and I just had nothing to offer anyone, and was just sort of this you know. In some cases, like literally balled up in my home, just, you know, a ball of suffering. But it wasn't like and it made me it really caused in me a lot of self-doubt about, you know, my worthiness of love and affection,
you
know. And then sometimes you'll, you know, like with this one, you know, maybe you put on a few pounds or something, or you know, your muscles atrophy in some way. And suddenly you get this idea. And like, I noticed it, that like, I'm a big guy, and like, I've always I'm not good at fixing stuff. I'm not like particularly like tough or cool. I don't wear leather jackets and ride around on Uncle Jesse's motorcycle. But the one thing I always had, and I never thought about it until it was gone, was that I was like strong, you know, like I felt like I could protect people if I needed to. And that went away, and I really did not feel like much of a man any longer. And it was interesting to have that sort of that inward gender stance, like to think of myself in that way. Because I think if anyone else said that, I'd be like, "That's ridiculous. You're a human being. You're, you know, who cares if you're, you know, manly or whatever." But to have it taken away from me, it was a little devastating. And now that I'm back, I'm bench pressing automobiles in the parking lot, I realize I'm still a loser.
I can see all of this clearly from the outside of, like, for you to be able to see that you are enough as you are. Because it's not about being strong. It's not about those things. It's just knowing that there's never, ever been anybody on this planet that has been you.
True.
And there never will be. Mm-mm. So you being you is this unique thing that the world needs.
Yeah. I like hearing that.
Yeah.
Go on.
Yeah. So when your friends who care about you want to help you, they don't want anything in return. Because if you were, if Madeline needed something, you wouldn't need anything in return. So it would be the same for you.
You're right. I just know, because I'm close friends with Madeline, that the world needs Madeline. And the world needs me. The world, in not in like this, that didn't come out exactly the way I intended it. But the world does need me. Madeline, I'm not sure about.
No, I'm kidding.
Stories about Hoda. No, but you're right. It's a genuine love. It's mm-hmm. not about it's not about what this person offers in return.
Well, and I feel like when you, especially like when you were having a lot of throat problems, like I remember like finally you being okay with people like bringing you things or like because you couldn't drive for a minute. So like people like picking you up and like driving, like doing very easy things that like any friend would do for a friend. But I like remember having a conversation with you where you were like, I normally hate when people, I would normally never let someone like bring me to nature well to like get the things I need to. And I remember just feeling so happy that like also that you were letting me do that for you. Cause like for such a long time. Yeah. Like,
oh, absolutely.
Yeah. It felt like, I mean, even just from the outside, it felt like a big deal and it felt like such a relief that our friendship could like become reciprocal, whereas before I felt like you know, you were always the best and the nicest and always did a thousand things for me, and I was like, thank goodness I can do something.
Right. See, I never thought of I always thought of you doing a million things for me. I guess that's just how we
I think we're not dissimilar, like part of my thing is like I'm a little bit like I like to feel very useful to people also, you know, like so that's like I think me feeling like I really wanted to help you is much more me being like, I feel validated in a relationship when I can be helpful and useful to someone. Yes. And a lot of times people are like, don't just help me, just hang out with me.
I love this because you guys are mirrors and this is all worthiness stuff and value stuff. So,
No, totally. And I think it's a big deal to put people in a position where they can succeed in helping you. In the same way that, like, you wouldn't ask your poorest friend for money because they can't help you and then they feel bad about their lack of finances. But if you know somebody can help you, whether it's something small, like, not small, but because it was a really big deal to me, people coming and picking me up and taking me to Nature Well. Like, you did it, like, every day. Like, not every, you know, like, for a week or so. Yeah. Like, when I needed it the most, you were there every day and you insisted on it in a way that, like, forced me to accept it. But that more than anything, it was just like there was an opportunity for my friend to be a good friend to me. Yeah. And why would I deprive my friend of that opportunity? That's like the best thing you can do for your friends is make them see how valuable they are to you just by being themselves.
Well, that's something I learned this year was like how to receive, because I could really see now the best gift you could possibly give back to the giver is receiving.
Yeah.
So, because like when we give somebody a present and they're so happy, doesn't it feel so good? And you just want to give them more gifts. And it's like when I flip that around, I'm like, okay, when I receive a gift, just be the best thing I can do is enjoy this.
Yeah.
That's the gift of giving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When they receive it.
Yes.
Because it sucks when they can't receive it.
Yeah. No, totally.
Yeah.
Especially because to some extent, whatever that gift is materially, that gift is you, you know? Mm-hmm. Like you're giving the gift of your friendship and that time that you've spent together has informed you of certain things about this person. And now there is this material possession that represents, one, how strongly you feel for this person, and two, just that it was you that thought of this thing. It was you that went out and purchased it. It was you that wrapped it and handed it to them. It wasn't just like, it wasn't just that you willed into the world a good thing for your friend. Yeah. You were that will. You were the force that brought upon this goodness. Mm-hmm. And then other people seemed to pay it forward.
Yeah.
Man.
Well, this.
This is great,
this
guys.
This is great. Yeah. This was so great. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much
for having me. Thank you for being open.
I feel different after this one. Like there is a bit of catharsis.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. And guys, give us your money.
Give me your money.
Get to that Kickstarter. Yeah. You want to see a movie about this? Of course you do.
Yes, you do. Yeah.
Get in that Kickstarter.
Charstarlene.com. Look it up. We'll post on Twitter and Facebook and yada, yada, yada.
Yep.
Our favorite social media website, yada, yada, yada.
Yada, yada, yada.
we'll let you know where to go. But if you want more of this cool brain, then give her some money so she can make a movie.
Yeah.
Give her some money.
Give her some money. Hashtag give her some money.
Hashtag give her some money. Thank you.
Thank you.
So sometimes during our interviews or our intros and whatnot, we like to mention something about old Twitter. We've We're at Definitely Dying. Mm-hmm. I'm at Ben Axelrad. Madeline's at Madeline M. Walter.
Oh, that's my.
That's Matt, yeah. So yeah,
I didn't know what it was.
That question segues nicely into the point of this little exercise, which is that we would like to learn how to tweet better.
Yeah,
we're not outstanding at it.
We don't really know how to do it. Ben knows how to do it like a little better than me, and I genuinely like I created my Twitter account a few, like maybe 4 years ago, because I was putting together a packet submission to write on at midnight.
Oh, yeah.
And so I only followed corporations. So I only follow like McDonald's and BP and like also like politicians who I thought would make gaffes who like now are not even relevant people anymore because that was like 4 years ago. And I have not used Twitter since.
Can I just say that there are few greater tragedies on this earth than the fact that you, Madeline, did not get a job at a game show based on Twitter. Madeline has never tweeted once. She's retweeted twice. And it was very hard for her to accomplish. And so... So, to that end,
I have two tweets.
Madeline's got two tweets. neither one is an original.
Oh yeah, Alexis pulled up my Twitter page, and I've never seen her laugh at this much at anything. And all we ever do is try to be funny.
Hey, what do you say you drop us a line and throw on the hashtag Madeline is engaged, so that Madeline can engage in the Twitter life?
Yeah, I'm trying to engage in social media.
Yeah. Because it clearly makes everyone's life so happy.
I just look around me and I see everybody so happy. Yeah. And I ask them why. And they're like, I'm in constant contact with people who I'm not really friends with. I'm never around real people. And I'm always jealous.
and since neither one of us knows how to Pokemon Go either, we're going to stick to the old tweets.
Yeah.
So, why don't you get us involved? Join us in the conversation. Yeah. Maybe you got something you want to tell us about how you're definitely dying. That'd be great. Maybe you just want to give us some tips on how to better involve our social media constituents.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that's not a term that people use in regards to tweeting.
I don't think so. Followers.
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 Man's one up on me.
Oh, my gosh.
I gained a Twitter constituent today. So, yeah, we'll get back at you. Madeline promises.
I promise.
Madeline promises 100%.
Yeah.
That she will engage with you in response.
I will engage with you. It's a pledge. Ben put Twitter on my phone for me.
This is true.
In order for me to do this. Yep. So I'm serious about it.
Hashtag Madeline is engaged.
Oh, yeah.
Woo.
This has been Definitely Dying. Thank you guys so much for listening.
You can follow us on Twitter at Definitely Dying. And until next time, stay healthy.
This has been a UCB Comedy production. Check out our other shows on the UCB Comedy Podcast Network.